Hello and welcome to episode 2 of Inside Acting Podcast. My name is Albert Meyer.
And my name is Trevor Algott.
And this is a podcast for artists by artists. And what we hope to do with this podcast is interview actors, musicians, painters, agents, managers, casting directors, all kinds of artists, and bring those interviews to you.
And we also want to keep this as open a dialogue as possible. We are not the only actors in LA by a long shot, nor do we know everything or any even close to everything. So anybody who has any questions or comments or wants to join the conversation, shoot us an email, shoot us a tweet on Twitter, send us a comment on the webpage, get in touch with us. We'd be glad to keep a dialogue going.
Yeah, it's all about having a collective experience and sharing ideas. We want to share good ideas. We want to hear what you guys have to say, because as Trevor said, we are not the only two actors. So we may have started a podcast, but that doesn't mean that we should be the only voices on the podcast. So we love your voices on the podcast. There's plenty of ways to get in touch with us, as Trevor just said, email, Twitter, the website. And I also was thinking, Trevor, what would be kind of cool is if they want to, they have the means to actually record an MP3 and send it to that email. Might be kind of fun.
Yeah, that'd be really cool. Yeah, our email address is insideactingpodcast@gmail.com. And if you have a microphone connected to your computer, you can use GarageBand on a Mac, any number of programs on a PC. I'm not really familiar with them.
AudioForge.
Sure, is that free?
Mm-hmm, I think so.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, whatever you can, record it on your cell phone and then email the MP3 to yourself if you know how to do that. And send it to our email. We'll play it on the air. We'll be glad to discuss anything you have to say, whether there's a question, comment, love mail, hate mail, whether you just think Albert's sexy, whatever
stop
it is.
It.
Just
stop it.
shoot us the comment. We'd love to hear from you.
So speaking of which, just before we started recording, Trevor and I both put out a post on our Twitter and Facebook saying that we were going to be recording right now. So hopefully we'll get a couple of replies of people who have questions or comments, things that they want discussed on the air. We keep saying on the air.
On the
not
recorded
really
air.
On the air. We're on the recorded air. But, that's pretty much as close as it's going to get to a live feeling here, but it might be kind of fun. So maybe we'll try to keep our recording time regular, and that way people will know when they can tweet
yeah,
us.
And we should probably send out like a little notice like throughout the day a couple times saying, hey, remember at 6:30 today or whatever, we'll be recording. We actually have a couple people that have already gotten in touch with us, not necessarily for this episode, but based on the last episode, we've gotten a lot of good feedback.
Yeah, even after one episode, we've got a few people we'd like to thank that have contacted either Trevor or myself or both. So let's see who we got. Esteban Oribe, I think he contacted both of us saying, great podcast. Thanks for your feedback. We really appreciate it. Make sure you're subscribing and telling your friends about us. Marcella Riley as well. And I have one more. Yuna Love is her name on Twitter. Thank you all for your comments, and we really appreciate it. Keep it up. Let us know if you also have questions. We really appreciate the reposting that you did for our first episode, and we'd also love to hear if you have any questions or comments as well.
Yeah, it might just be fun to discuss. We may not have the answers, but maybe we can just open a dialogue.
Absolutely.
Cool. So Albert, before we go into the interview today, which is a really cool interview with a buddy of mine who used to be my coach in this it was over the telephone, but a teleseminar that I took, basically educating artists on how to better manage their finances.
Something we could all use?
Yeah. Well, it was great. I took it twice, actually, and it was really great to talk with them. But before we go into that, I know you got a lot going on. You just had a play that closed this weekend.
Yeah, we talked about it on episode 1. My play did just close, although they're talking about an extension.
Cool.
So we'll see how that goes. They know they want to do one more week of like a workshop, because it technically was a workshop production that I was involved with. They're talking about doing another week of workshopping with a possible actual produced run later on, maybe in a couple months, like January, I believe.
Right on.
So we'll see how that goes. But some very good things coming out of that. One of the other cast members' manager came to see the show. Really, really took a liking to me. Pulled me aside after the show. Wanted to talk to me about a meeting and you know, find out more about me. So we've been emailing each other back and forth, and so I'll keep everyone updated on how that goes. But it's just kind of interesting because I've had an agent since I graduated, and we talked about in episode one, I graduated from UCLA, and I've had an agent since I graduated, so it's been over 3 years, and I've never had a manager, and I didn't know if I needed one, and I still don't. So I think for if anybody out there is listening to this and they have an agent or they don't have an agent and they're thinking about getting a manager or they're talking to a manager, keep following along with this process because I'll keep you up to date on how it all goes. I think it will be really interesting to sort of make this semi-public what I'm going to be going through over the next weeks with this woman. I'm really looking forward to that dialogue. So if you have questions or you think there's something I should, because I haven't had my meeting with her yet, and I probably won't until after this airs. So if there's like questions that you think that I should, you know, be asking her, tweet them at me, twitter.com/digitalactor.
Right on.
You know, say, don't forget to ask this. Don't forget to ask, you know, how many clients do you have? I mean, I have my list going, but anything that you think would be good to add to that list would be great.
Cool. Right on. Yeah. I unfortunately, I only caught the second act of that show.
I know.
And I opened the door and just kind of looked in, and I didn't know the space, so I just saw right in front of the door were a bunch of actors with lights. I didn't know if I was going to walk onto the stage.
Yeah, I said, workshop, so it was a very, very small space.
I like those, though. I like this. The more intimate the venue, the better, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Because it just gives you more of a chance to connect.
Well, our theater, I mean, the Los Angeles Theater Ensemble, which we talked about in episode one, we work out of the Powerhouse Theater, which is 75 seats. So
yeah,
just this really big black box theater, which is great. It's great for us.
And that's a great venue, too, because it's small enough that it feels intimate, but it's big enough that you can pack. I mean, I think we can fit, 90 people in there if we make sure this doesn't go out to the fire marshal.
Yeah, I was going to say, if we're not breaking any fire marshal rules, yeah, there's probably about 85, I'd say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Legally, 85 legally.
Right. But anyway, in the second act, there was a moment, and I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, where I just kind of grabbed my seat, and my first instinct was to get the hell out of there. So it was pretty cool, man.
Good. Well, that's good. You know, I like when, an audience has a visceral experience at the theater. That's to me, that's very cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very cool. What else
so
is going
the show,
on?
So the show closed, and then... well, actually, before the show closed, this happened before. I'm getting my timeline a little mixed up, but at some point this week, well, right now, as we're recording this podcast, I am currently on the cover of Backstage.
Booyah.
Which is very, very, very cool. They did an article, it's the college edition of Backstage, and they did an article on recent graduates of musical theater programs who are doing musical theater work professionally post-graduation. So I thought about it after I was asked to do the interview. I thought about it and I thought, you know, actually almost every professional theater experience I've had post-graduation was either a musical or had music in it of some kind.
Yeah. Your bio's not, or both our bios are not on the website yet, but you sent me yours today, and I was reading it. I was like, holy shit, this guy's done a shit ton of theater work since he graduated.
Yeah.
And I mean, I know we talked about it last time. I said, every time I turn around, you've been cast in another show, but I looked at your bio. I was like, wow, seriously, they've all almost been musicals.
Yeah. And only about, 20% of that has been paid, but
yeah,
you know,
still you're like UCLA's poster boy right now. musical theater program.
Literally. Well, Well, I was on there with another musical theater grad, Jessica Wynn, who was Jessica Armstrong when she was at UCLA. Jessica Wynn's her professional name. And Ben Giroux, who actually went to USC and did their theater program there. And I met him through mutual friends at USC. So it was very cool showing up to the photo shoot and seeing them. And then after we showed up to the photo shoot, we found out that there's a chance that it might be the actual cover. And we were, all three of us were like, oh my God.
That would be amazing.
So, and then it happened. It was totally random. I was at this marketing meeting for the Center Theater Group, and And a friend of mine sent me a text message. Another girl that I did musical theater with at UCLA sent me a text message. Congratulations on your cover while I was there. And I didn't even know that it... And so that's who told me was that friend. And I just kind of put the phone back into my pocket and looked up and told the people I was talking to very sort of casually because I was kind of in shock. I'm on the cover of Backstage. You know,
that's cool. What do you say? Well, you've had a bunch of auditions this week. I'm just wondering if you've noticed any sort of correlation.
Not really. I mean, I had to really sort of... I knew that there was going to be a reality check for me. I went to those auditions, you know, feeling very confident, not just because of the Backstage thing, but I had a lot of auditions this week. And I remember after leaving one of the auditions, I was like, that didn't really go that well. Like, it went well for me, but like, it didn't seem like they were interested at all or whatever. And it was just sort of like, I just had to remind myself, I was like, it doesn't matter. Like, I you know, I'm on the cover of Backstage and I'm auditioning and I'm not booking things. So like,
yeah,
it's a reality check. You know, you just got to stay humble and remind yourself that, you know, there's still a lot of rejection. I mean, yes, it's a great thing. I took a bunch home to my parents' house. You know, it was my dad's birthday this week. I took a bunch of copies home to them and my grandparents, and I'm probably going to frame one. And next week, there's going to be somebody else on the cover.
Yeah.
You know, who's probably way more famous than I am.
It's funny, man. We both went and saw Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo with the Kirk Douglas mm-hmm. recently here in Culver City. And I remember talking to a couple of the actors afterwards who were like our age, you know, they're like mid-20s
yeah.
Actors. You know, I think probably Albert or I could easily have been cast in one of those roles. So we were very much the same kind of actor. And I was talking to these guys after they're playing to sold-out houses, to really enthusiastic crowds. And afterwards, one of them's like... I was like, so what's next, man? Thinking, you know, he's got a movie lined up or something.
Right.
He's like, I'll probably go back to waiting tables and and just auditioning. And I'm like,
yeah.
And it just kind of blew my mind for a second. I was like, no, man, but you're like kind of famous right now, but you're not, man. Once that job ends, you just go right back into the crowd.
Yep. There's a great book that deals with that a lot because it's direct interviews with actors. It's called Making It on Broadway, Actors' Tales of Climbing to the Top. And it was edited by a friend of mine. And it's a collection of interviews of mostly sort of musical theater Broadway actors. You know, Colm Wilkinson, Antonio Banderas is in there because he was in Nine for a long time. Sarah Uriott Barry, like all these like really famous Broadway stars. And one of the biggest takeaways from that book is just how it, like, there's people in there that won Tonys. Like, literally won Tonys, and then they couldn't get work, like, the next year.
Wow.
So, you know, it's always a struggle. I mean, well, that's kind of what today's interview is about, is that we shouldn't be struggling necessarily,
right.
But it's always a fight. Fight's a good word, right? Because that implies passion, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not easy, you know? And I mean, everybody tells you when I started telling people, I want to be an actor, I'm going to go to LA, I'm going to try this, everyone was like, it's a tough business, good luck. And I kind of just didn't really sink in until I realized that this lifestyle is so up and down. Like, mm-hmm. you can do like 4 paying gigs back to back to back, and you think like, all right, this is great. And then you might not get cast for 2 years. And you might even be a better actor than when you did get cast. But I mean, a lot of it is within your control, which is actually not this interview, this episode, but the following one that's going to be out hopefully in a few weeks. There's a lot that you can do, but there's also a lot that you can't.
Yeah.
So it's like, it is tough, man. If it was easy, everybody would be doing it.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like, you know, if you've ever worked in management, which I have, and you have as well, Trevor, we both worked in management.
Yep.
You know, you have that whole conversation about controllables and uncontrollables, and you know, you do what you can with the controllables. You try to do your best with those controllables. You try to, you know, make sure that all of that is, for lack of a better way of saying it, under control and going well. And then with the uncontrollables, you just kind of like take them as they go, roll with the punches, try to make, you know, smart choices and smart changes if need be. Mm-hmm. And that's it. That's
yeah.
all, you know, that's all you can do. So I'm excited about that interview, that episode.
No, it's,
we can revisit this topic.
It's great. Yeah. He and I talked for 2 hours, so I got some editing ahead of me.
great. So what's been going on with you?
Not a whole lot. I one thing that is very cool. I don't think we mentioned this last episode, but I had my maybe we did. I had my first direct booking where I didn't have to audition.
Yeah, we did talk about it.
Did we talk about that?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I shot it last week. Mm-hmm. And it was just, you know, it was the same show. It was 1,000 Ways to Die. So it's this silly, campy, you know, webisode / TV thing. But it was really cool to not have to audition and just get that call. And I mm-hmm. don't know how much of it was attributed to my following up with the casting director when I was done with the audition. I don't know how much of it was attributed to my researching her and knowing a little bit about her when I walked into the room and knowing her name. And because I don't know if a lot of actors do that, but it was very cool to kind of get that call. And hopefully soon that check, which won't be much, but it'll be something.
I guarantee you, Trev, that it was a combination of all of the above. You know, yeah. Doing your research, doing your homework, going into that room, knowing who she is, knowing, you know, ways of connecting with her, having a good audition, good enough obviously to be cast. You were probably a gent on set because that's just who you are, and you know, following up after the audition, following up after the shoot. I did the same thing with Howard Meltzer when I got cast on Hannah Montana. And I'm pretty sure, I mean, he kind of even hinted at this when I asked him if we could meet while I was just kind of, when I had downtime, when I was on set. And he obliged, and I went up to his office, and we talked for almost an hour. And he kind of hinted at this, but without saying it, you know, in so many words, he kind of said, you know, that one of the only reasons he wouldn't necessarily be able to cast me again is because he only does that one show. That one show is so popular and so makes so much money for Disney that he doesn't have to work on any other shows. He works on, I think he works on maybe one or two more, and they're even a younger demographic. So right. I would never have gotten cast on anything on any of that. But, you know, I guarantee you, Travis, a combination of all of those things, just being really persistent and just being a good person, you know, that goes a long way, especially in this business.
It does. I'm starting to discover, the more that I'm out here, the more I'm doing this, that it's so much of your being cast in something is the people sensing that you're going to be easy to work with on set.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. Especially if it's a play. I mean, you just said on set, if it's in the theater, you have to spend a long time with that person because you have a rehearsal process,
and you're
which could
be
anywhere from like 4 to 10 weeks or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you're going to have a run, which could be, you know, 6 weeks or 4 weeks or more than 6 weeks. Who knows? Like, they don't want to deal with an asshole. I mean, there's no other way to say it, you know?
Yeah.
They don't want to deal with somebody like that for an extended period of time.
Especially in some high-stress circumstances, as inevitably happens with every theatrical production in the last, you know, 3 or 4 days.
Or on set, where everything's go, go, go. You know, they want it done now. There's, you know, multiple PAs and ADs running around just yelling at everybody, the extras, the crew, just, you know, because time is money, you know? Yeah. And so they don't want somebody who is going to be obnoxious, for lack of a better word.
So listen, all this said, we're actually starting to get a few little comments coming in. I got a couple Facebook messages as well as a tweet.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm jealous. Nobody's been, no one said anything to me.
I got a couple here. Let me see. My commercial agent says hi. You can follow her on Twitter at Diary of an Agent. That's all one word. Twitter.com/Diary of an Agent.
She's, that's your agent.
Yeah, my commercial agent. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I actually follow her. She's fantastic.
Oh,
she'll answer questions on Twitter.
I can't even tell you how amazing she is, not only as an agent, but as a person. She's constantly thinking outside the box. She's always upbeat, always enthusiastic, always working her ass off, and so personable. Like, I am extremely blessed to have fallen in with her. That was just pure luck, and she's incredible. I have an interview planned with her, so you guys are gonna get to hear everything straight from the source with her.
Yeah, that's fantastic. She'll tweet us out then in that case. That's fantastic.
So,
she the other night was saying, you know, if anybody has any questions, you can tweet them at me, and I asked her opinion on the whole manager thing. You know,
I saw
we were talking earlier about, you know, this possibility of getting a manager, and I said, you know, what are your feelings on managers? And she responded, and I hope she's okay with me, you know, repeating this on the air.
Sure,
I mean, it was a public
is.
reply. So she said, some are good and some are bad. And I said, okay, well, what's good and what's bad? She said, well, the good ones let me do my job and just act as sort of a second cheerleader for the actor. The bad ones are sort of, you know, kind of put a wrench in the works and sort of get in my way. And so she didn't name names, so I don't have to name names, thank God. But, you know, I just thought it was great that she was, you know, willing to sort of give that kind of advice. And
yeah.
And I have an agent. So I was even, you know, asking her, even though I already have an agent because she, you know, happens to be on Twitter. So
yeah, she's incredible. Anybody who's listening to this, if you're on Twitter, which you should be, follow her. Twitter.com/diaryofanagent. She's incredible. Her name's Chris. Tell her that you heard about her through the Inside Acting podcast with Trevor and Albert. She'll know who you are, and she'll say hi. She's incredible.
And if you are creating a Twitter account for the first time, don't forget to follow us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Don't forget to follow us. And of course, that's on the website. We got a message from my friend Tim. I think he's kind of dicking around, though. He wants to know that if he can get cast for something using his Facebook picture.
Is that the one where he's posing with a porcupine?
I don't even know, dude. I steer very clear of his Facebook profile.
Yeah, he's actually... I don't even know if... He probably doesn't want us to blow his cover. He has a... alternate.
He's like Sacha Baron Cohen, where he's got like three or four different
characters. He doesn't have a personal Twitter account, but he has his character's account. Yeah. So I don't want to blow his cover in case he's trying to keep that under wraps. But yeah, he's really funny. I think he's talking about a picture of him in a really nice suit. It looks like crushed velvet. I mean, and it's like really nice. And I think in one he's holding like a cigar, and in another one he's holding a porcupine.
Like a live
animal? Porcupine. Like a live porcupine. And
I didn't
know
those existed.
Where that
came
from.
That's like a myth, you know? No, that's actually, that brings up a neat point, because one of my roommates was watching the Ali G show when I got home today, and I remember thinking about this. I read somewhere, it might have even been a Twitter post from Dana, who we should also mention, because she's been wonderful as far as helping kind of disseminate some really good information for actors. But I think she had a Twitter post where she said that there was a survey done of all these actors and all these entertainers, and she found that the ones who had the most consistent careers were the ones who were doing stand-up, if we're talking about just actors. The ones who were doing stand-up comedy.
Interesting.
Yeah, which is really interesting. And if you think about it, like, I can't think of many stand-up comics who have kind of died off. And you've got like the Rob Schneiders and the David Spades and the Sacha Baron Cohens and the Robin Williams, and they're all still kind of around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they make stupid movies, but the movies are funny, even though they're stupid. I mean, I didn't see The Hot Chick, but I heard it was actually really funny. But I mean, I thought that's really true. So I mean, what Tim's doing, having these kind of characters, and he makes these YouTube videos and stuff where he just goes on and on in as these characters, it's actually kind of brilliant in a way. Because if the right people see it,
well, we talked
he's
about,
got these different kind of alter egos to fall back on.
Right. When we talked about last episode, the webisode, you know, and that kind of takes different forms. Like, it doesn't necessarily have to be a narrative webisode, you know, like with seasons and stuff, kind of like Dorm Life, at Dorm Life on Twitter. Those guys are awesome, too. They're friends of mine from UCLA. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be sort of a narrative. It could just be, you know, like, what's that one... that one girl who's really popular on Facebook, or not Facebook, YouTube. I Justine, but it's not I Justine. There's another girl, like Lonely Girl.
Oh, Lonely Girl.
Lonely Girl.
Is she still
15
around?
Yes. Wow. Yes. And that's what I'm saying. Like, there's all these sort of alter egos that people have created. A friend of mine from high school, Stevie Ryan, who is also on Twitter, she's created multiple sort of alter egos, and she ended up, I found out that she was doing this because I saw a story about her on like the 11 o'clock news or something about this character that she created named Lola. I'm sorry if I'm getting that wrong, Stevie, but it got her on the news because people thought she was real. They thought she was Borat. They thought she was, you know,
Bruno. Yeah.
And then when they figured out that she wasn't, they were kind of like, some people thought it was brilliant, some people were really upset. So it's you know, there's a million different paths to where you want to go. I think she has a national, like, Cheetos commercial that aired during, you know, the Super Bowl. So, you know,
good for her.
There's a million different paths, and a lot of it has to do with, you know, I was talking to this actor, I can't remember his name right now, and I don't want to waste the time looking it up, but he's a very successful actor. He's been on a lot of sitcoms, especially Seinfeld is the one that most people know him from. But he told me, you know, with the way things are right now with contracts, SAG, AFTRA, the way that things are going right now, it is almost imperative that you create your own work.
Hands down, man.
Yeah. And get it out there and put it up on YouTube. And you sort of gain this following doing that. And that sort of, I don't know, legitimizes you in this mm-hmm. age of the celebrity and somehow can get people on board with you as a performer, as an actor, and then put you in stuff that will pay you.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Well, it makes you somebody worthy of following. It makes you somebody that you're doing something that's admirable, that can be looked up to, that people can jump on board. That it makes you one of those people that people want to talk to and be connected with. Because sure. you make things happen, you know? I mean, and that's huge. I mean, it takes effort, but man, there's nothing there's like no excuse now, you know? With mm-hmm. with like such a minimal budget, you can make something as long as you have good content, and that is your characters that you create. That's that script that you're working on, you know? Shoot the trailer for it or something, you know? Whatever it is, just make something, put it out there, and all of a sudden, you're right, it legitimizes you.
Yeah.
Because you're actually doing stuff that people can see, that you can burn a DVD of, hold in your hand and say, look, I made this.
Right.
You know, that's, right. I mean, that's powerful stuff.
All right. So maybe that's a good segue into industry news, and which is the last thing we have before the interview.
Yeah. Before we jump into this interview, what we were talking about this just before we started recording. There's a SAG contract that got shot down.
Yeah. So it was pretty big news. I think it happened today, maybe yesterday. No, it happened today. The 75% of video game voiceovers are done non-union. And so what's going on right now is AFTRA and SAG are both in talks with EA, as well as like 70 other, you know, game companies. Obviously, EA is one of the biggest. Activision and Blizzard are probably the second biggest. There's some, you know, I'm a big gamer, by the way.
Yeah.
Confession right now, a big confession. I'm a huge gamer. It's one of my other hobbies. But so AFTRA and SAG are talking to these video game companies and trying to figure out if they can unionize some of these voiceover contracts. And I guess the negotiations were going okay for AFTRA, but not really with SAG. And so SAG went to vote on this new contract with the video game voiceover work, and it got shot down. And so they've kind of got to go back to the table. And there's a lot of fear right now that it's not actually going to end up back on the bargaining table. So do some more research on that, because, you know, we don't have time. We don't always have time on the podcast to talk about every little nook and cranny or detail about these news stories, but we want to try to include interesting industry news as a regular segment on the podcast.
It seems like a pretty kind of messy area right now that people are trying to get covered.
Yeah, well, I mean, with voiceover, I mean, I've never done it before, but, you know, there's no reason why people shouldn't be getting paid for this kind of thing. And you know, remember, love them or hate them, the reason that the unions were created in the first place was to protect us. You know, it used to be back in the golden age of Hollywood that the studios owned the actors. MGM owned Judy Garland. They owned her. And that's, you know, there's a lot of people out there who say that that's what killed her, you know, because they had her on, you know, uppers when she was on camera and downers to make her go to sleep between scenes. It's frightening stuff. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's the extreme, obviously. But the unions, that's why they're there. They're there to protect us. They're there to make sure that we get paid. But there's so much going on right now. I mean, with the strike that just happened, I mean, it is really, really messy. The whole thing is extremely messy. And you have, it's dividing actors, people on either side of the debate. And it's really unfortunate. And it makes it difficult for people like us who aren't as well known, who are sort of still in the midst of quote unquote breaking in, to do just that.
Yeah. You know, that reminded me, actually, because I remember reading a Twitter post from someone named NC, who we're actually going to be interviewing in the next few episodes as well. And I think it was from her. And she had a post where she retweeted, I think it was SAG New Media. Mm-hmm. They have a Twitter account as well. Mm-hmm. And it said that studios now want to own actors' tweets. So, like, if you are represented by CAA or whatever, or and you do a Sony picture or something, they want to have contracts signed that for a certain amount of time during the promotion of that movie, that every tweet that you put out, they own.
Yeah, well, what it was is Cameron Diaz and another actor, I can't remember who it was, Cameron Diaz and someone else, are the first people to have this happen to them, where they basically, as a stipulation in their contract, it was saying that they couldn't, Either they couldn't have a Twitter account or they couldn't tweet about the movie because the studios are starting to get really nervous about losing secret information to the very public, very wide world of Twitter and the internet. Mm-hmm. So
it's an NDA, basically.
Yes, an NDA that includes social media.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, very interesting.
So tell us a little bit, give us a teaser of the interview.
Yeah.
Or at least just set it up and we'll jump right in.
This is a great interview. This is an interview with a guy named Brian, who I think we mentioned before was one of my coaches on a teleseminar that I did with a company called Abundance Bound. If you've been on Now Casting or LA Casting, you get any of their newsletters, I'm sure you've seen articles written by the people that run this company, and they're really great people. I took the seminar. It was a 10-week seminar taught via telephone. You kind of call into a number and you have a big teleseminar, and it's run by a coach or whatever who kind of helps direct everybody, and you have homework assignments and everything. And Brian was my coach on both times I took this teleseminar. I took it a second time because they offered it to me for free as a brush up. I don't want to give too much away, but he got in some pretty serious trouble with money. Hmm. Like one of those things where you're living in your car and you just stop paying your bills.
Wow.
And I don't say that to like embarrass Brian or in a way. He talks about all this in the interview, but it's interesting now because he is now one of the most like pleasant, peaceful, organized and financially sound and just savvy people I've ever met. And I went to the graduation of some school, some 2 or 3 year Meisner training school on Ocean Boulevard in Santa Monica a few weeks ago to see a friend of a friend graduate. And they had Paul Sorvino speaking. Oliver Stone came and did a speech.
Cool.
And the valedictorian of the class got up to speak, and it was Brian. And I was like, holy shit, I know that guy. You know? So I went over and talked to him. And I knew he was an actor, but I didn't know that he was doing that program. And I did not know that he was a valedictorian. But I wasn't surprised because he's that kind of guy.
Right.
So this is a really great interview. I highly, highly recommend that, and he'll mention this in the interview too, everybody check out AbundanceBound.com. It's a really great service that they offer, which is just educating actors and other artists on how to better manage their finances. And their whole goal is to dispel the myth that to be an artist, you have to struggle financially. I can't vouch enough for any of their products. They have several different kind of things you can look at and subscribe to or get. Without further ado, I guess we can just jump in.
Go for it.
All right. I'm sitting here with Brian Bellomo. Of all the people that we have set up for interviews, I'm probably most excited to be talking to Brian today because Brian's a pretty dynamic guy, and he's really been an inspiration to me and helped me kind of transform my financial life. Brian's an actor. He just graduated from, what was the school again that I saw?
The Baron Brown Studio.
That's right, the Baron Brown Studio in Santa Monica it was Ocean, right?
It's on Wilshire and 3rd.
Okay.
Wilshire, so right near the beach.
Cool. Yeah, it's a really great acting school. It's a two-year program, I believe.
That's correct.
And so he's a very accomplished actor, and he also helps coach actors and other artists in personal finance through a company called Abundance Bound, which I've had the opportunity to take twice. And it's really helped to open my eyes to a lot of things about personal finance, which I think is a huge block for artists of all callings. So I'm really excited to be sitting here with Brian. So, Brian, thanks so much for doing this.
It is absolutely my pleasure, Trevor.
And I don't really know much about you. I don't know where you're from. I don't know how you got into acting. I don't know how you fell in with Abundance Bound. And you're definitely very on top of I don't want to say personal development, but like we were saying before, during some of those calls, you would bust out some pretty amazing kind of insights as far as money and how it's tied to emotion and how we work as human beings. So I'd love just to hear a little bit about how you got started with all of that.
It started back in the 70s. I was conceived, born, and raised in the heartland of New Jersey. I grew up in what I would consider to be just a relatively conservative environment. It was very, you know, public schools were great in Jersey, and wasn't much of an artist growing up. I did some plays here and there. I knew, you know, very early on that I wanted to act, but it wasn't something that was overwhelmingly developed in me until I got to college primarily. I would say I did a fair amount in high school. And when I got out of high school and into college, this whole world opened up to me about art and what the possibilities were there. And I realized that there was this kind of ticking thing in me entirely growing up that kept me highly depressed and probably overweight and unhappy, and I never really knew why. And I think once those kind of passions were unleashed in a way, things started to settle and make a little more sense. And maybe it was just puberty, I don't know. But I think we all kind of experienced that in a way. My experience led me, after 2 years in college, to realize that the purpose of education, at least at that stage, was to emotionally develop. And I did so much socially and emotionally in really primarily my first semester of college that by the time I finished my second semester at school, I went to a university called Bradley. And I actually went there because I had, in high school, been part of the forensic team, which is speech and debate. So that's, I guess, what it's called worldwide, but it has a name called forensics. So it's not like CSI forensics where you're going in and examining evidence or anything like that. It's really that you would take a play or some other, you know, medium, maybe you take a poem or something like that, and you'd actually break down the material to about 10 minutes in length, and you'd perform all of the different characters yourself. And so you'd storytell and you'd pop into different people. And one of the pieces that I did was had like 18 characters or something. And you had to stand in a like 3x3 foot space, so you could really only contort your body and your voice. And after a couple of years, I realized, after taking all of my acting courses, that I didn't want to pursue liberal arts in any way. I didn't want to study in any way. I didn't want to go to class in any way. I wasn't interested at all in continuing this path of the kind of conservative, straightforward life thinking. I don't think I would have put it that way at the time. I think I was just so fried and emotionally just done with things. And I had this really powerful conversation with a friend of mine. I said, I just don't want to go back. And she said, well, why are you? And it was like this whole world just shattered in front of me. And I said, I really don't know. And this whole experience came over my body. And I turned to her in the middle of the car and I said, I'm leaving college. And it was just that sudden. It was that profound. I just knew everything in my body said, stop, do not continue this. And it was so hard for so many years because my life was spent validating the fact that I didn't have a degree. It took many, many years even to come to peace with that. But I can say that I wouldn't be an artist today, nor would I have the ability to communicate, because I was forced to really learn that with people. I was forced to be in situations that were uncomfortable and forced me to prove my worth, I suppose, in a way. I wouldn't be the person that I was today if I had continued on a path that everybody was supposed to be on. So I moved out to LA about a week later, much to the emotional chagrin of my family. In fact, that was the thing. Not only was I the first person in my immediate family to go to college, I was like the first person in my large extended Italian family to go to college. So it was emotionally, I think, a very big deal for them. I think they had felt that they had somehow failed, maybe.
I was going to ask how that went over with your family, because I'm sure we have people out there that may be listening that are dealing with the same thing. You know, they don't want to go to college.
My family did have a hard time with that, partially because I had just moved away from the nest. I think that was it. I also, when I left college, I had two choices. I said I could move to, well, I had three, I suppose. I could move back home, which was really never a legitimate option for me emotionally. Just, I didn't want to do that. Which is interesting now, because I think there's a generation gap. something has changed in the more recent generation where so many people return home after school and then they get stuck there and they don't know how to make a transition out because it's such an expensive world and it's a scary world.
I've seen more and more news articles about people moving back home literally into their 40s or so, like literally living off their parents. And
it's the millennial generation.
Yeah.
It's a very unique one. I feel for people who are in their early 20s now or who are still in their teens and are dealing with also with the barrage of technology and what that does to the way we communicate and the way we develop. So I said New York or L.A., that was it. And I had a friend out in L.A. who had a couch. I'm sorry, I didn't have a couch, I had a floor. And so I lived with my little lamp and my sheet for like a good 18 months.
18 months living on a floor?
Well, I think maybe it was a little less than 18, but it was certainly the first 9 to 12 months that I was on the floor. And then I transitioned to some, I don't know, bed somewhere. I don't know. Whatever. It's nomadic. It was 19. I was 18. Hey, man, live and let live, right? So that's how I ended up out in Los Angeles. And that was, gosh, a good long while ago. And I spent a number of years in L.A., and I had this great thing happen to me, which was the worst thing. So I started having to pay back all of my student loans, and that was not pleasant at all. And thankfully, I had half of the student loans that many of my friends did. And after about a year, I said, I don't want to work. Like, work. Yeah, I just don't want to work anymore. So I left my two jobs, and I had this genius idea that I was going to take my two credit cards. I had a Discover card and like a Citi card, and they had $2,000 balances on each. So I was very excited by this. And I said, I'm going to take out the maximum amount of cash that I can take out, which is $2,000, and I'm going to live on that for a month, pay my rent and do everything. The next month, I'm going to pay back all of that I took off with my other credit card and then do it again. The problem is, my 19-year-old brain didn't consider the fact that once I paid one off with the other, then that one was filled. So that whole process gave me 2 months to live. And then after that, I was like, well, now what do I do? And it was like such a shock to me that I somehow couldn't do this kind of round robin thing where I just, you know, borrow from Peter to pay Paul. So that was hilarious. And I just kept getting into more and more and more and more debt. I just had mountains of debt, well into the five figures, plus all my student loans, which were very high, even for a smaller university. So just to kind of segue into how all of this developed for me, it really developed because for 2 years straight, I would get, back when we had answering machines, I would get a phone call every day, and I'd come home and it'd be blinking, and it was like, doo-doo-doo, this is Discover Card. Please call us at 1-800-DISCOVER, or whatever their number is, every day. Every day, I would get 1 to 2 to 3 calls like that, because I wasn't paying back anything, because I couldn't pay back. Even though I was working at the time, I'd finally succumbed to getting temp work, and oh God, I passed out flyers on the street. I did so many crap jobs.
Anything you could.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it was in one of those moments of the economy, too, where it was right before the bubble really grew, so it wasn't a wonderful time. And without a college degree, people look at you and they say, okay, even if you're a reasonably smart person, we're going to assume that you're in a temp agency, so you don't have certain skills, so we're going to give you like the least thing until you've proven yourself to move up the temp food chain.
Data entry.
And I am not in any way poo-pooing the temp world. I've done it for many, many years, and it's a great option, actually, for a lot of artists. Anyway, I wasn't paying back any of this debt, and it just sat like a weight on me, and it really is this kind of big pink elephant in the room. You just carry it with you. Someone was telling me the other day that men tie their identities into whether or not they have a job, and that was very shocking to me to think about, and I thought, well, it's kind of true. There's this feeling of like wanting to have purpose and wanting to feel like you're capable and accomplished, and I don't know that all men feel that, but I certainly have suffered from that at moments. And I was the one that did this. I put myself in this situation over and over and over and over again. Knowing that, and knowing that I had no tools whatsoever to take care of it, I knew how to balance a checkbook, I suppose. Oh, this is hilarious. When I first moved to that LA apartment where I lived on a sheet for a year, one of my roommates This is so weird. He used to sit. He was so upset that he had no money. He worked at Macy's at the time. I'm sure Macy's employees get paid better than he did then. But he would sit. I don't know why he did this. He would sit every night with his checkbook open, and he would stare at it. And I don't mean stare like it would take a couple of minutes. I mean, I would go out, I'd get some food, I'd come back to the apartment, and he was still staring, almost like, grow another zero.
Right. That's
grow another zero. Right? I don't know what he was doing.
Yeah.
To this day, now that the secret is out and everybody's manifesting their entire lives, I wonder what he thought he was accomplishing.
Yeah.
Because really, all I wanted to say was, why don't you take half that energy and go start a business, or half that energy and go write something or go create something? Geez, do a painting. Maybe you could sell and that'll add, I don't know.
Right.
So I had all this debt and was very unhappy about it, and without this college degree, just feeling like an absolute fraud, walking into any situation. Very young, very youthful, and you know, when you're 19 or 20, you're always trying to hang out with the big kids. I always felt that growing up. All of my friends were older, so I got into a pattern of just always feeling like I was going to be the young one there, and that I had something to prove, and it was very hard to know that I was really failing in so many areas of my life, because money is really tied to so many things. It's tied to our feeling of status, which is superficial but true. It's tied to what we feel we're capable of accomplishing, because it sets limits and parameters on the actions that we're going to take. It helps develop or not develop our friendships. You know, we move into social circles based on our financial standing. So all of those things, in addition to simply just what employment we're able to take on.
Yeah, and that's so interesting to me, because what is money anyway? I mean, if you try to define it, what is it? And especially today, increasingly, it's not anything physical. It's a couple numbers on a hard drive somewhere in Oklahoma, you know, that some server
accesses. It's a zero and a one somewhere, right?
Yeah.
A byte.
And yet it determines so much of our kind of fate.
So it's really interesting to see how much power we give that. In our culture.
There's a great CD set by this guy named Frederick Lehrman called Prosperity Consciousness that I just love, and I do talk to my students about it, but he really opened me up to the idea that money is energy, and that, you know, I'm not really a capitalist, nor am I communist, nor am I socialist, but I do feel that it has its kind of place, because it's this cycle of energy that gets transferred to people. So the money that I spend today helps another business or some other service provide a service to somebody else, and that service in turn becomes something that I would need, and it does become this kind of cycle. And so, you know, if you look at the economy today, it's because that cycle is moving so slow, because people don't want to contribute into the river, I suppose. But you're right, it's really not anything. Money is not anything except what we make it so.
Yeah.
When I was in seventh grade, I had a history teacher who took out a dollar bill and he said, "What is this of value?" And I was like, "And it's green, you know, it's green paper, and it I spend things with it." He said, "Well, why do we care?" And everybody in the class was stumped, because we had seventh grade brains. And he essentially said, "It doesn't mean anything. It's just the faith that we put into it. So the faith that America puts into this dollar, and then we measure that thing." That's so weird, right?
It is so strange.
It doesn't
really
make
think about
any
it.
Sense yeah. whatsoever. But we do, and we do that. And then not only do we measure what that faith is, we measure that faith against other people's faith in that across the world. So somebody looks at it and goes, "Well, I don't think that the American dollar is that important to me."
Mm-hmm.
Like, why does the rupee mean anything to me? It doesn't mean anything. So that's why they can spend 40 million rupees to 1 cent or something. It just doesn't really, I mean, you know, my kind of logical brain just shuts off at a certain, or my artist brain, I suppose, just shuts off at a point. I just don't get it. I don't get why that is. But we live in this place, so it's like, I guess we have to work with it, right?
Yeah. I'm reading this really interesting book right now called Your Money or Your Life. It's apparently one of those kind of personal finance classics, and I picked it up because I heard about it on a financial blog that I read. And it's really interesting because it talks about money as being life energy, as being, you know, basically one of the exercises it says, like, take your job, find out what your true hourly wage is, so what you're getting paid per hour, but then, you know, going through your expenses, subtract how much you spend on clothes for that job, how much you spend on food, get transportation, that kind of thing. Money to decompress, you know, quote unquote, after your job. and then break it down to what you're actually making. What kind of profit are you making after you spend all that? It trains you then to go and look at every purchase that you're going to make with that money as, is this worth, you know, X number of hours of my life energy? To really break it down and say, well, if I really only make $4 an hour, this TV is going to cost me 400 hours of my life. And I can't get that back. That is a finite amount of energy. So then the whole book kind of goes into this kind of diatribe on frugality and being really kind of conservative with your money. And then it talks about the possible anti-patriotic stance that many people will take when they look at you. Like, it, because, you know, if you look at it, our economy, it only works if people go out and spend money. So if you're not spending money, you could be considered, in some extreme view, a terrorist.
It is. Well, and I think too, you impress upon me what the emotional quandary is, I think, in artists specifically. You know, I mean, you know, obviously, because you've taken, you know, the course that I help teach, that it's very kind of close and dear to my heart being an artist. But we have this, I think, just this split, almost Gemini-like personality in us that we want certain things very sincerely. We want kind of like this normal path, and we want, you know, it's like we prolong everything. We prolong, obviously, sometimes getting married or having children or having a house or having all these things in service of a dream, sometimes, you know, a superficial dream, simply just to be famous or to be seen. And on other levels, it's a much deeper one, which is to create communion and create community and offer catharsis to others. So, but it impresses upon me how that question lives in us. I mean, I'm now furnishing a new apartment for the first time in a while, and I've been dealing in my mind with this question of, well, just what you're saying, how much time have I spent to acquire these dollars, these little cents, and all this kind of stuff? How much energy have I put into working to build something? And now, how quickly would it go? And would the purchase that I make actually satisfy that thing? Would it bring me the same amount of emotional joy as the sweat equity that I have built in order to get it? And I think, you know, for artists, I think that's why so much of the time we just shut that off. We just say, forget it. I'm going to live this kind of simple, peaceful life, or I'm just going to focus on my art solely, and I'm not going to put any attention into finance, because it seems to me, and I don't want to speak for, you know, the community at large, I suppose, but it seems to me sometimes that the value of it is rather superficial, is something that we feel we don't need, when what we really need is to contribute more. What we need is to give back more. What we need is to use the tools that we have, which are natural, which are not outside of ourselves. They're not this external thing that we can purchase or acquire. It's something that we have to bring ourselves to bear on. And the problem for me is, that's not the universe that we live in. You know, I live in America, in Los Angeles in 2009. And because of that, there are certain parameters and rules that I have to follow. It doesn't mean that I have to be a quote-unquote consumer, nor does it mean that I have to run out into and build a log cabin and be walled in out in the, you know, out in the sticks somewhere. But there is probably a balance. And that balance is strikingly important to achieve if you want any semblance of really being able to fully approach and contribute to your art in the way that you best can. It means that you can't ignore certain opportunities and tools that exist to you. And one of those tools is money. One, you know, it's not something that has to deter you from the things you want. It actually can support and benefit the things that you want. And I came to this from such an opposite place. I came to this from a place that said that thing is kind of the root of all evil. Money doesn't grow on trees. Money's not easy to acquire. It's going to take so much time and effort and labor and everything to get all these things.
And that's the first step of the course.
Right, right. Yeah. It's how to develop new feelings about feelings. Feelings is such a funny word. But develop a new relationship to how you think about your money. Mm-hmm. You know, and as a result, the way we think actually is really deeply tied to how we feel about it. And you know this, Trev, because you've come through this a couple of times. But if I say to you, you know, if you say to me, I really want to be rich, I really want to do great things with money and have lots of money, but really inside what you feel about it is that rich people are greedy and self-serving, well, those two things can't possibly exist together. How could they possibly exist? So you're going to do everything you can subconsciously to sabotage your efforts to actually get the thing that you want. So it's about kind of re-tinkering and reassessing and reapplying new connections to the wires, your emotional wires inside. So that way your nervous system starts to have a different feeling about money and feeling about anything having to do with money.
So let's talk a little bit about the course then, about Abundance Path. How did you get involved with that? I mean, obviously you were in kind of dire straits.
I was. Oh, yeah. So we left the story that I was really just in the worst place ever. So I'll just really quickly kind of catch you up to where I get to Abundance Path, which is actually a number of years later. But the short is, after amassing all of this debt, the worst thing happened to me is that I went into the hospital for a day. I was in between a couple of jobs without insurance and racked up another five-figure medical bill.
Jeez.
On top of that. So that was a great wake-up call. So I did the best thing I could think of is I moved from Los Angeles to New York and just forgot about everything. A couple of years later, there was a knock on my door and they said, "Hi, are you Brian?" I said, "Yes." And they handed me a slip of paper and they had passed a judgment against me in California for all this money that I owed, specifically for the hospital bill. And that was my big wake-up call to say, okay, I need to do something differently than I am. Frankly, I was doing nothing. So doing anything was a major paradigm shift and improvement. And I started tinkering around with Excel, in a great amount of depth, and started building little spreadsheets for myself and started saying, how do I get on top of this thing? How do I make it work? And I actually started to turn kind of like my crazy former roommate. I would stare at my Excel for a while, like willing my numbers, and that never occurred to me till this moment. So I'm never going to talk about him again because I feel kind of silly now. But he did, I guess, to teach me something, which is that you could stare at something long enough and get ideas. One of the great things about just having graduated this Meisner program after 2 years is not that I feel that I have any more skills necessarily as an actor. It's that I feel that I have more competence in going into creative problem solving. That, as an artist, period, is our job. We are creative problem solvers. So whether you are a writer and you're solving the problem of what the dramatic question is, or you are a director and you're solving the problem of how you assemble these people and get them inspired and get them to understand what the story is, or you're an actor and you have to figure out what your function is in the piece, we are creative problem solvers. And so you need to have a wide toolbox in order to do that. Math and all the things that inhibit a lot of artists from approaching finance are much the same way. We are not trained early enough on to really use our minds in the way that is necessary. Really, when you are expanding and becoming a better individual, it's because you're banging your head against a problem over and over and over again. And we don't have the time, as we're growing up, to be given that opportunity. Many kids just fail and walk away from it. That's why, you know, it's unfortunate that there's this kind of stigma that women somehow are worse in sciences than men, and it's not really true. It's the same kind of thing. We have to be encouraged to press on and press against that thing over and over. So I guess I mentioned that because I was thinking about looking at my Excel sheet and looking at that, those problems over and over and over and over and over again forces you ultimately to stop thinking the thing you're thinking and start thinking new thoughts. And those new thoughts, you know, it's like Einstein said, you can't solve a problem with the same thinking that got you into it. Those new thoughts lead you to new actions, and those new actions lead you to new information, and that new information gets to be processed, and all of a sudden you're expanding and growing in ways you didn't think. And it doesn't have to be something overly profound. It just means you have to show up and apply yourself a little bit. And as artists, we're doing 100 things constantly. We have many projects all over the place. How is it that we're able to show up and be present for one of them out of the 80 that we're doing? It's because we've trained ourselves to be that kind of creative problem solver and sit with that problem as long as we need to in order to be present. And when I think about Abundance Bound, the thing that's great about it is I do my best to try and impart that to students, that's really, you can use those same tools that you have as an artist and apply them to your finances in this kind of creative way, have a creative life, and still satisfy the demands that society is placing on us in order to be solvent and use that money for the greater good. So I came to Abundance Bound when I moved back to Los Angeles a number of years later. I had acquired lots of information. I was investing at the time, and I was doing other things, and I was on a path to be out of debt. And my girlfriend at the time had signed up for a casting director workshop, and she said, you know, they're offering an afternoon about finance for artists. And I kind of laughed because most of my experience had been, when it came to finance for artists, had been a mutual fund manager coming to try and get people to sign up to do mutual funds. Well, because actors need a retirement plan, so why don't you just come and join, you know, UBS or Payne Webber or whatever company it was, Merrill Lynch, and you know, we'll sign you up for monthly recurring payments, and now you have a mutual fund, you have a, you know, Roth IRA, and you're set to go. And that was their finance for artists. Not poo-pooing that on any level, it's a great thing to have, but it doesn't teach you a thing. Yeah. All it does is teach you to give somebody else your money and hope that things go well. And now in this poor economy, everybody's going, where's my money? Where's my money?
Right.
So I very skeptically and reticently agreed to go, but it was a New Year, it was like January of that year. And I said, oh, okay, you know, I've got my red ribbon on my finger. Why not? I'll turn over a new leaf, see what this person has to say. And it was Miata and her husband Adam teaching this day-long intensive, which went through the artist prosperity system, which is the 9 steps that we teach in our course. But then she started putting things into a context for artists in the second half of the day, where I think things really, in the artist prosperity system, really get cooking. The first half of the program is really foundational. It's really about everything you need to know to make sure that you are clear as to where you're beginning, where you're standing. You know, you can only walk from where you're standing. That's this moment. So if you don't like who you are right now, if you don't like the situation you find yourself in, you're merely the residual effect of every thought and action you've taken up to this point. And if you don't want that anymore, all you have to do is from this moment change a thought, change an action, and then the residual effect of that will be somewhere different for you. Doesn't mean it'll be better or worse, it'll just be different. And, you know, a teacher, your primary function is not to espouse what you believe. It's to get others to open up to what they know is true. This work is profound. I wish that I had no need to teach this at all. I would be so happy if the next moment we all woke up and we had tools at our disposals and artists were able to get rid of the idea that they somehow had to starve in order to do their best work. I think it's important. I do want to make that distinction. It's important to be hungry as an artist. You want to have a fire and a passion. But it doesn't mean that you have to sacrifice because someone has told you or the conventional wisdom says that in order to unleash that fury in you and tame it in an artistic way, that you have to have everything else in your life in chaos. Quite the opposite. You're rarely going to do your best work until the other elements around you are stable and sane.
Is there a common mistake that you see many artists make with their money? Like, or let's rephrase it maybe to be more positive. If you could give one piece of advice to artists and regarding money and their financial lives, what would it be?
I think the best thing I could say, well, there's two things, but I'll say the best thing. The best thing is please don't ignore it, because you're not ignoring it. It's a weight on your shoulders. It's a clamp on your back. It's a shackle on your ankles, and it lives with you every moment. And that's not a negative thing. That's your reality if you're ignoring it. You just may not be hyper aware of it, but you're emotionally aware of it, and it will ultimately drag you down from the person that you ought to be, from the potential and actualized person that you wish to be. So that's the biggest thing. Don't ignore it. Find a way to make a part of your time about money, about not necessarily acquiring money, about getting clear about your money. What's really coming in and going out each month? What, you know, and that's not just balancing a checkbook. All balancing a checkbook does is tell you whether or not you have enough money in that account to pay a bill. I mean, get really clear. Like, we have, and that's the other reason I think that people avoid it, is that we have a disparity in the way income comes in. It's very random. You know, some months I'll get a residual check and other months I won't. Some months I'll get a job and other months I won't. And some months I have 2 jobs and other times I have 3 jobs. How do I know what's coming in? You have to average those kind of things over time to really get as close to a picture as you can. And the same thing with your expenses. Some months you're going to be paying for headshots and other months you're not. Some months your car is going to break down and other months not. You can use a longer period of time to really average those things. So that's kind of like the foundational kind of stuff. Don't ignore what that actually is in your life. Don't assume that things will magically improve once you book that job or you get the long-running thing on the show or whatever the thing is, whatever that carrot on a stick is for you, or even simply just the misnomer that I'm going to do it once things get a little bit better. Well, if you don't know what things are now, how do you know where things are when they're a little bit better? You can't measure. So get a picture of it. Get into it enough that you can develop a bit of control about it. Information is control, period. You will have confidence and you will have self-assurance that you can make the next step. So that's the most important thing. The second thing is, in very much an artist spirit, artist way kind of thing, excavate what you really feel about money. You could do all this work with me, but ultimately, if you believe, it's like you listen to T. Harv Eker, The Millionaire Mind. If you believe that that thermostat, that there's everybody has a financial thermostat, and if you believe it's at 72, right, and then eight people walk in and the heat goes up to 75, the thermostat will crank in and move it back down to 72. Or if it gets really cold, it'll crank back up to 72. If you believe that you are set to make $6,000 a year, and some random number, then if a windfall hits you and you get the show and you get all the things that you want and you get a windfall of cash, whether it's for a one-time thing or a 3 or 4 year period, I can guarantee you, until you have tamed what your feelings are about these things and replaced old ideas and beliefs with improved ideas and beliefs, that you'll go right back to where you were. Your job really every day is to plant seeds and to water them. It's not about the results. It's not about anything else. It's simply about doing the little amount that you can with the tools that you have and learning about yourself. And as artists, we're doing pretty well. That's part of what our job is. So I think we are introspective and we are learning about ourselves and we're learning about emotions and human behavior and all these things. And we're putting them and processing them. We're in that habit. Now, if you can just do that same kind of thing and apply those same thoughts and feelings and behaviors that you would put into learning about your art into your money a little bit, you'll find that you're actually improving all of those things. Change will happen as quickly as you allow it, but most change for people is frighteningly scary. I think we want some new life, but when we think about what all those pieces are to actually put that life into practice, it becomes very overwhelming. So what I encourage people to do is do the little thing that you can today and see how that feels, and then do a little something more and do a little something more and get accustomed to what it feels like. Rather than sending a message, we were talking about this earlier, Trevor, rather than sending a message to your nervous system somehow that all the mistakes that you're making and all the missteps that you have, start sending little positive messages to your nervous system. So send a positive message about your finances, that you showed up and you put your receipts in a pile. Like, that's a victory. So you start to have a good feeling about it. Start to get positive messages that you simply spent 15 minutes writing about what your experience was like with your parents with money. That's another positive experience you've had. Now you've done a couple of things. You're changing your trajectory slightly. And the more you do that, the more you get in the habit of doing little things that, even though they seem frighteningly overwhelming at first, when you realize you can ease into them and they feel open and available to you as options, you start to feel better, you start to have greater self-assurance, and that tiny bit of a trajectory will ultimately impact and affect your life in profound ways.
So how can people find out more about Abundance Bound and the work that you're doing?
Our website is www.abundancebound.com, and you can reach us there. You can sign up for we have free downloads that you can that you can use. We have different spreadsheets and other things to help you get started. We have articles, we have a blog, we have a forum that we're developing right now. The idea is that we are expanding this community of artists to change the paradigm of feeling like we have to starve and suffer in order to best serve the needs of our community and our art. I don't believe that. I know that Miata doesn't believe that. Our company as a whole does not believe that. And we want to encourage and unite a new movement of people who feel that there are other options out there. And so if you feel that that's a legitimate possibility for you, if you just want to find out more about us, or if you want to start the dialogue and spearhead your own groups and all this other kind of stuff, we want to be able to be there as a resource for you to make a new choice and hopefully affect that trajectory just a tiny bit.
Cool. I've had the good fortune to work with Brian twice now on two 10-week financial teleseminar courses, and it's been amazing. And I feel very lucky that we're so local to each other, because not only have I learned a ton, but I've also made a good friend. So
yeah.
You guys check it out, because if you have a chance to do it, you will not regret it. It's really, it can be life-changing if you put the work in. So, Brian, thank you so much.
It's
been awesome.
It's absolutely been my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me here, and to everyone out there listening, thanks you. I get nervous and humble. Thank you very much for participating. This has been great.
That was the interview with Brian Belomo from AbundanceBound.com. I hope you guys enjoyed it.
I just want to keep Brian in my pocket so I know what the right decisions to make, you know?
Yeah, he's a very cool guy, and he definitely knows his stuff. So I encourage everybody to get in touch with Abundance Bound, and if you can, get in touch with Brian. He's fantastic. He coaches, I think, almost all of the teleseminars. I think they've been reduced now to 6 weeks instead of 10 weeks, but it's worth checking out.
Definitely.
Before we wrap up, we want to give a quick shout out to a Twitter friend of ours named Dana. She has a blog at HollywoodActorPrep.com. It's a really, really fantastic blog. She's constantly posting information for new actors, seasoned actors, a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff. She goes to film festivals. She interviews people. Check it out. She's not only very informative, but she's been in the business for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. She did Big with Tom Hanks. She's got a couple clips from that up on her website.
Yeah, she also had... she also posted something when Neil Patrick Harris was doing the hosting for the Emmy. She posted a clip of like the first time he was ever on television, and she was in the scene.
Oh, cool!
So I mean, she's been in the business for a long time, and she gives great advice. And it's not just on acting or anything. You know, she talks about like around tax time, she'll have whole posts about, you know, doing your taxes and tips for what you can and cannot write off. And
she has a lot of she makes a lot of downloads and stuff too. You can download like Oscar nominee sheets and stuff. She makes little PDF
files. Whenever there's a large awards show coming up, she always has something like that, so you can kind of follow along, that kind of thing. It's a great website. You can follow her on Twitter. It's going to be kind of hard to describe. It's __ Dana, D-A-N-A, _ So two underscores, her name, Dana, D-A-N-A, and then two more underscores.
Yeah, and I think there's a link to that on her website, which again is HollywoodActorPrep.com.
So definitely check it out. And once again, please send in your questions. We want to talk to you and about you and for you guys.
And
on
with you.
And with you, yes, on the podcast. InsideActingPodcast@gmail.com is the email. You can also leave a comment on our website, InsideActingPodcast.com. I'm at Twitter.com/digitalactor.
I'm at Twitter.com/TrevorAlgott. That's TrevorAlgott. And we'll have we don't have the bios up on the website yet, but hopefully by the time you listen to this, we'll have all that stuff on the website, so you don't have to remember it.
Don't forget to subscribe in iTunes.
Write us a good review in iTunes. We'd love to have that kind of support. Or write us a bad one. I mean, that would suck if you did, but we would like a good one if you can.
Yes, if you liked what you heard today, tell everyone you know. If you didn't, keep it to yourself.
Yeah. And last but not least, we don't have a donate button up on the site yet, but we will probably in the next day or two. Any dollar amount you can contribute to us is hugely appreciated. No amount is too small. This podcast is always going to be free for everybody, but it's not free for us to produce. So to help us cover production expenses, including travel time and file hosting and things like that, kick us a few bucks. We would love it, and we can keep going.
Yeah. So tell your friends, retweet us, follow us on Twitter, retweet us, repost, find us on Facebook or the other various social networking sites. Don't forget to subscribe and tell your friends. We're trying to build up that initial subscriber base right now so that we know that there's people listening out there. We're not just talking into a void.
Echo. Cool. Thanks so much, guys. We'll see you next time. Take it easy.
Bye.